ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello and welcome to The World Today. It's Wednesday, the 3rd of April. I'm Rachel Mealy, coming to you from the lands of the Turrbal and Yuggera people. Today, Samantha Mostyn to become Australia's next Governor-General. Who is she and how might she carry out her duties as the King's representative? And moon time. It's been more than half a century since humans first set foot on the lunar landscape. Now there are plans to create a moon time zone. But why?
As there's more spacecraft from more nations and more cooperation on the moon, different nations are going to have to work together. There's going to be more communication between spacecraft and people on the moon. Linking all of the time back to Earth is going to become less and less practical.
First today, there's been an outpouring of grief and outrage from the international community over the deaths of seven aid workers in Gaza. Australian Zomi Frankum was working with World Central Kitchen when she was killed in an Israeli airstrike. The charity says the attack isn't just on it alone, but on all humanitarian organisations delivering aid in the most dire of circumstances. Elizabeth Cramsey reports.
Zomi Frankum was killed alongside six other aid workers and a driver in an Israeli airstrike in Gaza. As the global chorus of condemnation grows, Prime Minister Anthony Albanese spoke overnight with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu.
I emphasise the importance of full accountability and transparency, and Prime Minister Netanyahu has committed to full transparency about how this tragedy could possibly have occurred.
Mr. Netanyahu admits the IDF is responsible and has committed to an investigation. But he also says this happens in wartime. Foreign Minister Penny Wong says Australia wants answers.
International humanitarian law applies to Israel, and that law protects civilians, and that law protects aid workers. I don't think this can be dismissed in any way. And we expect full accountability.
Israeli newspaper Haaretz is reporting the aid workers were killed because commanders and forces on the ground acted contrary to orders and instructions. John Kirby is the US National Security Council coordinator for strategic communications.
It's devastating to see these images and to hear these early reports about the steps that they tried to take to protect themselves. But the Israelis, look, they've already said this was on them and they're doing this investigation.
World Central Kitchen says the team of aid workers were travelling in a three-car convoy, including two armoured cars branded with the charity's logo, in a deconflicted zone, and its movements had been coordinated with the Israeli army. Stefan Dujarric is a spokesperson for UN Secretary-General Antonio Guterres.
The multiplicity of such events is the inevitable result of the way this war is currently being conducted. We reaffirm yet again the need for an immediate humanitarian ceasefire.
So what does this mean for aid supply in Gaza? Juliet Toomer is the UNRWA Communications Director. She says UNRWA is still blocked from delivering aid in the north after Israel accused its staff members of participating in the October 7 attacks.
A quarter of a million people are in the north of the Gaza Strip. They are stranded there with very, very little food. And so the World Central Kitchen provided people with food. And with UNRWA being banned by the Israeli authorities, I don't know how these people are going to survive.
She says Israeli authorities have to reverse the decision before it's too late.
The vast majority of the population there relies heavily on handouts from aid organisations. More people are going to die.
Reverend Tim Costello is one of Australia's leading voices on humanitarian aid.
When the known rules of identifying and deconflicting and saying we are there and the military, Israeli military know, when that has all failed, so many aid agency bosses say we're shutting down our program.
He says these events will put further stress on the families of aid workers.
The extraordinary nature of what these people do, the courage, the commitment to serve others, and the willingness to give up their lives. Every aid worker knows when you're going into conflict, that is a possibility. So this is extraordinary work. Zombies, our finest. These people are our finest people.
Executive Director of MICA Australia, Tim Costello, ending that report from Elizabeth Cramsey. This is The World Today. Thanks for your company. New figures today highlight the growing divide between the haves and have-nots in Australia. According to one real estate website, national home prices have soared 40% across the country in the 4 years since the pandemic began. At the same time, financial counsellors report a big increase in the number of Australians falling into financial stress. For more, business reporter David Taylor joined me earlier. David, where are property values rising the most around the country?
It's reasonably widespread, Rachel. National home prices grew by 39.9% since the beginning of the pandemic, with regions up 53.6%, outpacing capital city growth, 35.2% when you add all the capital cities up. Now, regional Queensland was up 66.5%, the strongest growth market since March 2020, followed by regional Australia up 66.2%. Now, with the state's capitals, Adelaide up 64% and Brisbane up 63%. So significant home price growth also in Brisbane over the past 4 years. That's seen its price growth outpace rival Melbourne, one of the more slow performers since March 2020, Rachel.
Some huge figures there, but David, there is new data from the National Debt Helpline, and it paints a really grim picture of those who are struggling to make ends meet.
A really stark contrast, Rachel. Those with property really seeing wealth being created at a stratospheric rate. Now, at the other end of the scale, in February, the National Debt Helpline dealt with 14,871 inquiries. That's up 17% on February of last year. So these are people calling up around the country, not sure what to do with their debt, maybe being wrangled by the bank as well, and needing help and financial counselling to work out what to do next. Now, the main areas of concern for those contacting the National Debt Helpline were housing, so mortgage stress and rental arrears, energy bills, general cost of living struggles, scams, as well as debt from the Australian Tax Office. So clearly people with those really big ticket items, but also, Rachel, the essentials, starting to cause some stress.
So the commercial banks and the Reserve Bank say that they're watching those levels of financial stress closely, but they also insist it's not at alarming levels yet. What's been the National Debt Helpline's response to that?
Well, Dominique Merrick is the co-CEO of Financial Counselling Australia. She insists that there is a problem, but it's quite confined to those who are really struggling, but it is getting worse. She says there's been an increase in the number of Australians calling for the first time.
We are seeing an increase of the number of people who are particularly struggling, but also the severity of their struggles. So where before we would have got calls about credit cards and personal loans, now we're getting calls about housing. So we know people prioritise their housing costs. So if people are unable to meet their housing cost, it's a pretty very likely that they're also unable to pay for their electricity or their telephone or all of those things. So you're seeing what's happening to the people who are left out of that, who are out on the margins. It's getting harder and harder.
So that's the co-CEO of Financial Counselling Australia, Dominique Merrick. And Rachel, what's clear is that there are more Australians thinking twice before switching the lights on.
David Taylor reporting there. While the spotlight is on Alice Springs, where a 2-week curfew remains in place to combat youth crime, other communities around the country are also struggling with a similar surge. State governments have put tougher policing measures in place in many areas, but is that having an impact? Alison Shaw reports.
In the fight against youth crime in Alice Springs, there's been a strong police response, but some are questioning the 14-day curfew on the town's youth.
The curfew could be unlawful, as has been pointed out by the NT Police Association.
That's Northern Territory Senator and Alice Springs local Jacinta Numbagimpa Price. She says longer-term social policies need to be adopted.
The government needs to really start to act appropriately to do things like protect our vulnerable, our children. If they're in dysfunctional circumstances, they need to be put in circumstances that are maintaining their human rights and ensuring their education.
Queensland is also adopting tougher policing, with specialist officers deployed to hotspots in a statewide crackdown on crime. John Raven is the mayor of the city of Logan, where the first officers have now been deployed.
We deserve more cops. And I know that talking to our police who are out on the streets doing the work, they'd love more resources.
The police operation is a temporary trial for 10 days, where officers will target repeat offenders and crimes like car theft and property destruction. But not all believe tougher policing is the right strategy when it comes to youth crime.
I think that making more punishments isn't the right thing to do. A curfew for a few weeks and maybe extended to a couple months isn't going to fix anything. It's just prolonging the issue.
Connor Bowden is a Tuggalaka and Goomuch man and rural communities advocate from the Northern Territory. He says the priority should be addressing underlying issues of systemic inequality that lead to young people committing crimes.
We need to look deeper than the surface problem, which is crime, and address the real problems, which are poverty and the defunding of remote areas and the dropping of livability in those areas.
In New South Wales, rates of youth crime have been skyrocketing across regional centres, according to official figures. Gunnedah Shire Mayor Jamie Chaffee says more policing is needed.
When you look at the police stations in rural and regional New South Wales, only 14% are opened 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, in comparison to the metropolitan areas, that it's 90%.
Some tough legislative changes have been introduced by the state government, like their controversial changes to bail laws, making it harder for some young offenders to get bail. There's also plans to create a new offence for posting and boasting, which could see offenders face an additional 2 years in jail if they post their crimes on social media. Gunnedah Mayor Jamie Chaffee says these are steps in the right direction.
With the post and boast changes to legislation and also some around the bail laws, we're really hopeful that's going to make a big difference. Again, focused on youth crime.
About 200 kilometres north of Gunnedah is the town of Moree, where $13 million of funding will go towards a pilot program tackling youth crime, with additional court resources and new bail accommodation for young people. The state's Premier and Police Minister are in Moree this morning to announce a new program with the NRL aimed at steering young people away from a life of crime. Jihad Dib is the New South Wales Minister for Youth Justice.
This is not going to be the be-all and the end-all. It's not going to be the thing that fixes everything, but it will make a difference. It's an NRL program, the Pathfinder.
The program provides diversionary pathways for at-risk youth by giving them unique access to the NRL environment and also an NRL mentor. Jihad Dib says crime is a major issue around the country, but requires individual approaches tailored to local communities.
Alison Shao. The prominent business leader and gender equality advocate Samantha Mostyn will become Australia's next Governor-General. Frank Bongiorno is a professor of history at the Australian National University. We spoke earlier. Frank Bongiorno, have we had a Governor-General like Samantha Mostyn before?
No, we haven't, because she's only the second woman to be appointed to that role. I mean, Quentin Bryce was appointed by the Rudd government back in, what was it, about 2008, I think, and came from a kind of legal academic background. She'd been a college head in university. Sam Mostyn obviously comes from a business background, has had a wide range of involvements in various organisations. There are perhaps some resemblances to Bryce, but also I think a very different sort of figure and a different career trajectory in all sorts of ways.
She's the first business leader to hold the role. Now, this surprised me. So we've only ever had governors general from the military or the church or the public service. Is that right?
Yeah, look, there's been certainly a dominance of a few professions. I mean, a lot from the judiciary over the years, going, I guess, right back to Isaac Isaacs, who was the first Australian born and had been on the High Court, of course. A few former politicians. Yeah, I mean, a relatively narrow range. And it also breaks the mold of recent years. I mean, there's been a real dominance, I think, of military figures over the last, you know, 15 years or so. I think in that sense, it does represent a significant change, really, and perhaps reflecting, I think, the sense that the office needs to be more reflective of the diversity of Australian society.
Yeah, indeed. The Prime Minister himself said Sam Mostyn is an exceptional leader who represents the best of modern Australia. How does a Governor-General get to express themselves in the role?
Well, I mean, it's often called a ceremonial role, but it's not. It's actually also a constitutional role. And it is worth, I think, pausing over this because we're moving, I think, into a situation in national politics where minority governments are probably going to become more rather than less common, just the way that sort of the party system is working. And, of course, that's where the Governor-General does exercise more of a role because the formation of governments sort of sits in this kind of grey area where the Governor-General is actually brought in often to exercise a little bit more initiative and independence than they would in other circumstances. I mean, there's conventions, they act on the advice of the government of the day, the Prime Minister of the day, but they're also responsible for the formal commissioning of governments.
So those skills of sitting on a board of directors and communicating with everyone might come to the fore.
Well, that's right. I mean, interpersonal relations are obviously very much a part of it, and the capacity to listen, to offer advice, to offer sensible advice that responds to a particular set of circumstances. All of these are very much a part of the job. So, yeah, I mean, I think the kind of trajectory she's had and, you know, that pretty wide set of involvements, you know, around obviously climate change and gender equity, has been an AFL commissioner, Reconciliation Australia. I mean, it ticks a lot of boxes in terms of, I guess, Australian society today. And yes, you would expect that very broad networks and long experience, I think, of dealing in kind of collegial and collaborative sort of situations. And I think that's a good thing. So, you know, we shouldn't take for granted, you know, having a successful Governor General does require certain skills. And she does certainly on the face of it seem to have those.
Frank Bongiorno, thanks very much for joining The World Today.
It's been a pleasure, Rachel.
That's Professor Frank Bongiorno from the Australian National University. What time is it on the moon right now? Even though it's been 55 years since Neil Armstrong first stepped onto the moon's surface, there's never been a standardised moon time. As NASA plans to head back to the moon and set up a lunar base, the US government wants to create a lunar time zone. Angus Randall reports.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Astronaut Neil Armstrong said these immortal words while stepping onto the lunar surface at exactly 10:56 p.m. Houston time, July 20, 1969. Apollo 11 ran on the same time as Mission Control because there's no time zone on the moon. That's about to change. Dr. Sarah Webb is an astrophysicist at Swinburne University.
For the longest time, we have just worked on Earth-based time systems, and we've sent things not only to the moon but to Mars. We've sent orbiters to other planets. And for now, it's worked relatively okay. However, we're going into a new phase of our exploration of the solar system, meaning not only are we going to be sending humans to the moon, multiple companies are going to be trying to send humans to the moon, different systems and different engineering tools. And what we need is a universal time to ensure that every different system, company, and even nation that send things up to the moon is able to communicate accurately and correctly.
Today, the White House has asked NASA to create a standard lunar time by the end of 2026, saying it's critical for navigation and communications. But it can't just copy an Earth time zone, because a second on the moon is not the same as an Earth second. Associate Professor Michael Brown is from Monash University's School of Physics and Astronomy.
Flight takes about a second to travel from the Earth to the moon, and the distance between the Earth and the moon changes as the moon goes around the Earth. And so the time delay changes as well. So that makes things quite tricky. Furthermore, clocks run at a slightly different time on the moon than they do on Earth because the moon has weaker gravity than the Earth does.
It's a difference of microseconds, but in the high-precision business of space travel, that's an eternity. So to sync things up, the length of a second on the moon may have to change.
The obvious thing would be to perhaps have a second that's based on a place on the lunar surface using an atomic clock, or something similar to an atomic clock, and then perhaps to have leap seconds as needed to synchronise that with, say, universal time on Earth.
under NASA's Artemis program, America plans to send astronauts to the moon by 2026. China says it's planning a manned mission by 2030, and Japan is following close behind. So, does the US have the right to impose its own moon time zone? Professor Jonty Horner is an astrophysicist at the University of Southern Queensland. He doubts other nations will complain about NASA doing the work.
I think everybody will get on board just because it makes the most sense. I mean, nobody wants things to go wrong. And if this is already set up, why would you not go with it? It's not something that will generate a huge amount of national pride or argument, I wouldn't have thought, saying, no, we're using this clock instead. It just makes sense and it makes life easier.
NASA plans to have a crewed mission orbit the moon by September next year before landing on the surface in 2026.
Angus Randall, and that's all from the World Today team. Thanks for your company. I'm Rachel Mealy.
Hi, I'm Melissa Clark from the ABC News Daily podcast. In Alice Springs, a 14-day curfew has been imposed on the town's young residents following armed riots and escalating trouble. Today, ABC Alice Springs reporter Lee Robinson on the cycles of violence in the Northern Territory and whether this stopgap measure will make a difference. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.